Good evening, I'm Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and I'd like to welcome all of you to Tuesday Topics, if I could only learn to speak. I'd like to begin by thanking our recorders this evening, Rachel Bader and Marlena Lieberg. We very much appreciate your help. And we would also, of course, like to thank George Bives of Talking Communities for making this software available to us, which enables us to record this kind of program. This evening, we begin what will be at least a two-part series, and it might even turn into three. I don't know. It will depend an awful lot on how much we find to talk about concerning the American Foundation for the Blind. The American Foundation for the Blind is an organization that's been around for a long time, and I'm sure our guest will tell us a little bit more about how it got started and so on. And while most of us remember the American Foundation as a place where you used to be able to buy products, it actually has always done a lot more than that and does many different things now. But I think many of us in the blindness community really don't have a good handle on many of the things that the American Foundation for the Blind does. I should, for the sake of clarity, indicate to everyone that I am a member of the program committee of the American Foundation for the Blind, which means that I have something to do with helping to chart the course that the American Foundation takes. But much more directly involved in what the American Foundation for the Blind does is our guest this evening, who is a member of the American Foundation for the Blind's Board of Trustees, as well as being the vice president in charge of, technical assistance and various other things for the Carroll Center. He runs their technology training center. And the immediate past first vice president of the American Council of the Blind, Mr. Brian Charlson from Watertown, Massachusetts. So welcome, Brian. And could you perhaps begin by telling us a little bit about the history of AFB, if you can? And if I've caught you off guard, then waffle.
You always start with the hard parts. So I'm going to give a very, very brief description of AFB's beginnings. AFB was started as an organization attempting to have a positive impact on the lives of blind and visually impaired persons, primarily starting out of New York City and then expanding to be not only nationwide but a worldwide organization. The most famous individual ever associated with AFB was Helen Keller, the original spokesperson for the organization, and certainly set to a large degree the eventual primary function of the organization, that is to help blind and visually impaired persons, not so much directly as indirectly through influencing policies and processes associated with blindness. It's been around for, I think, in excess of 75 years, maybe even longer than that, but I know it's been around for at least that long.
Now, AFB has done a number of things in its history, and I guess has really been many different organizations at many different times. But perhaps the role that it has become most famous for is acting as, if you like, a place where information is gathered and the policy needs of people who are blind are discussed. Would you agree that that's sort of AFB's primary role? And then perhaps, Brian, you could tell us a little bit about perhaps some of the recent shifts.
Well, I would say the number one thing that AFB can take pride in is having been the inventor of the talking book. In fact, under AFB, the long playing record, the LP, was first created and used to record the human voice. So I would say that's a great cause for pride of the organization. It does so many things, and many of us who are blind never realize the impact it's had on our lives. One, it is a producer of talking books, and has been since the inception of the National Library Service program that we all currently use on a regular basis. It has also been the primary publisher of textbooks on the subject of blindness through AFB Press. So if you have an O&M instructor, a rehabilitation teacher, a rehabilitation counselor, a low vision specialist, all of the textbooks, the primary textbooks for those fields are written and produced by the American Foundation for the Blind, AFB Press. Technology has been heavily impacted by AFB as well, both currently and, of course, as I mentioned, historically with the invention of the long plane record. Currently, they're very much involved in dealing with issues such as accessible cell phones, accessible glucose monitors, and a wide variety of other technologies. Sometimes it's directly involved with devices, but more times than not, it's involved in the establishment of standards for the production of those kinds of devices. AFB also is a research organization. In fact, if one says, where do I go to find out how many blind people that do X or Y or Z, how many there are in each country, whatever the statistic dealing with blindness, the likelihood is that you're going to go to AFB for that information. Although I mentioned earlier that AFB has its roots in New York City, it actually has offices in Huntington, West Virginia, AFB Tech, the technology arm, if you will, in Atlanta, Georgia, where the AFB Literacy Center is located, Dallas, Texas, where the Sight Loss Center is located, primarily dealing with issues of vision loss and aging, and AFB San Francisco, which has an employment primary mission, if you will, as well as the AFB legislative and policy offices in Washington, D.C.
Well, let's talk for a moment about governance, Brian. AFB is not a service delivery organization. That is, we don't, or AFB doesn't directly serve blind people as clients for the most part. And it isn't a consumer organization. It's not an organization of blind people. So it's sort of neither fish nor fowl. I guess we could perhaps describe it as almost a policy think tank, among other things. And as such, it is my understanding that AFB is run by a board of directors. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about that and a little bit about how the board works and perhaps even how my committee fits into the Price of Cheese, the program committee.
Yeah, I would say that if I were trying to give a one-sentence description of what AFB is, it's a private not-for-profit organization designed and operated with the purpose of creating system change to benefit those who are blind or visually impaired here in the United States and around the world. It is governed by a board of trustees, about 30 in number. They are made up of about 50% from the greater New York City area and the other 50% from around the country. It's a combination of your typical board of trustees, people of influence and affluence, vice president of UPS, of Chase Manhattan Bank, of Sun Microsystems, to mention just three. One of the Marriotts, Steve Marriott, who's visually impaired himself, also serves on the board of trustees. So it's more than 50% people of influence and affluence. The balance of the board of trustees is made up of people in the field and people with specific skills that AFB can benefit from. There we get into accountants and bankers and the like. And then there are those who represent the field. So there may be, for example, Phil Hatlin, the director or president, whatever they call it, down at the Texas School for the Blind. Myself, as a blind consumer, I am currently one of two blind people, if you count Steve Marriott as first being a blind person and not being a person of influence and affluence, and there's some question about that. And then there have been other members who represented teachers, rehab counselors, entities that do preparation programs, such as people from Florida State University or Kalamazoo or et cetera around the country who deal with the development of people in the field of blindness. That Board of Trustees, like almost all Board of Trustees, is self-selecting. That is, there is a nominations process and the attempt to bring on to the board the proper mix to have the board be as high functioning as possible. We in turn hire the executive director currently, that's Carl Augusto, and he in turn hires a management staff and on down the line that make up the AFB pool of employees. There are regional advisory boards, but they are just that. They're advisory boards assisting the regional offices, but also being there in order to be kind of an entree to local fundraising to support those primary functions of AFB. There are committees that are both standing committees, such as governance and nominating committee and the budget committee and finance committee, etc. And then there are committees that, though they're standing committees, they really help AFB design itself, the program committee probably being the most important of those committees, having the biggest impact on all of the other activities of the organization. There's also a committee that advises AFB on things technology related, and also one that deals with its website specifically. So there are many, many committees that serve unique functions within the organization, but beyond those that deal with the governance and finances, the most important of those committees is the one you're currently serving on, Paul, the program committee.
Brian, perhaps you could talk a little bit about AFB's website, which is www.afb.org, and give us some idea of some of the specific components of that website, which also represents a pretty good introduction to some of the directions that AFB is taking now.
Well, let's see. AFB's website is probably one of the more well-developed of its kind in the world. In addition to trying to pull together access to large amounts of information on the subject of blindness, and here I would include the directory of agencies serving the blind, also the world's largest collection of Helen Keller written material as well as photographic material, the general works of AFB Press are accessed through it both directly. You can literally purchase the pages of an AFB book that you would like to read, as opposed to having to purchase the whole huge tomes that make up some of the core literature in the field of blindness. They produce and distribute by way of the website the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness, periodical in the field of blindness here in the United States. Also, through several of its projects around the country, and I pick now particularly on the Literacy Center down in Atlanta, there's a number of pieces of material that they make available through the website, including a great game called The Braille Bug that introduces sighted children to the fascinating world of Braille, hoping that they will eventually, as the years go on, not only better understand what Braille literacy is all about, but also potentially become teachers of the visually impaired as a result of their interest in Braille in their early childhood. I'm right now previewing something else that will be going onto the website through the Literacy Center. That is a large collection of short video descriptions of assistive technology used by blind and visually impaired people, everything from the slate and the stylus to screen readers and magnifiers, etc. And then there are some services that are wound into it, such as Career Connect, an opportunity for blind employed persons to interact with those who are seeking employment and developing some skills on their part.
Let's spend a little bit more time talking about Career Connect. Career Connect was designed for who, do you think? And do we have any information at the moment about who's using it?
It's a very popular service. Career Connect attempts to do two things. One is to provide some material that will assist those who are looking to become employed or to seek upward job mobility within their current employer. It also attempts to match together individuals who are currently employed with those who would like to work in the fields those employed individuals are already working in. And it also gives you an opportunity as a person who's having difficulty with some aspect of your job to find somebody who's doing the same job somewhere else in the country or world. And they may have answers to the kinds of problems that you're having at your employer. It may be that you're a real estate agent and you're suddenly put in contact with a product called GoldWave, which can be used as a real estate prospecting kind of piece of software, and you want to find out if anybody else has worked out a way to get access to that.
And essentially the approach that's taken for the most part is the use of things which are called message boards. So these are ways where individuals can post messages and then have those messages responded to by others. The Career Connect site not only has information about jobs, but it also has some career interest tools and some kind of helpful hints for both high school students and young adults in terms of how to get into the world of work. So there actually is quite a lot there. One of the components of the website that we haven't talked about at all yet is Access World, and perhaps you could spend a little bit of time talking about what Access World is, and also perhaps about some of the technology information that's available on the AFB website.
To understand Access World, you have to understand its history a little bit. At one point, AFB decided that what the world really needed was a technology magazine. This was at about the same time that Tactic was being produced by Clovernook, I believe, and it was just going out of publication. And they wanted not to see that kind of thing in, kind of the consumer reports, if you will, of access technology for the blind. So they put together a team and started producing a hard copy magazine that one could subscribe to and attempting to sell advertising within its pages in order to support its continuation. The fact is that it never quite reached that business model. And first it attempted to cut back and only produce within its financial means. That didn't prove to be the most appropriate way for AFB to do that kind of thing. So eventually they moved from a hard copy model to an electronic model distribution of their news magazine. They utilize much of the research being done at AFB Tech in West Virginia, which has its own funding source to keep it going, so it didn't have to prove itself in terms of a financial model, and utilizing writers from around the country. A name that should be familiar to many people is Debbie Kendrick, who's written a number of pieces for it, as well as, again, the staff at AFB in the New York office, and to some degree the Washington, D.C. office, when the issues at hand have less to do with specific devices and more to do with policies that impact the accessibility of technology overall, things like web standards, accessible cell phones, access to electronic textbooks, and others. Did I mention that the current price of a subscription is zero? All you need to do is to go to the website and subscribe, and you'll get access to that e-magazine.
And it comes out every 2 months, I think, Brian, with a kind of an extra that comes out every other month, which contains kind of intermittent updates and indications of what's coming in the next major issue. why is AFB involved in the kinds of thing it is? What kinds of things it is? What does it perceive its role to be? Where does it see itself fitting into the continuum? And why is it choosing to go in the directions that it appears to be going in now?
Well, AFB has struggled over the years to define itself. What it did during most of its existence is it would find some topic, some function that it didn't see anybody else doing at a professional level and step into that vacuum, if you will. Over time, that meant that AFB had its fingers in absolutely every pie that deals with blindness, whether it be education, rehabilitation issues for seniors, technology issues, low-tech, high-tech, policy-related issues, issues on a national level, on a state level, and even in individual counties or cities around the country. The end result is they were doing a little bit for a lot of things, but not really succeeding in accomplishing any kind of major changes in any of the big issues. So AFB had its hard financial times during the time of the junk bond era. Some of the financial advice it was given was poor, and as a result, it had a more than 50% drop in its endowment. Eventually, they chose to sell the building they owned in New York and instead lease space and begin to distill themselves down into something a little leaner and meaner. At one point, they laid off more than half of their staff nationwide. And since that time, they've been attempting to, through a series of long-range plans, to distill down to things where they could feel they could have a real impact. One of the discussions I remember most vividly was when we took a look at the statistics about unemployment among the blind and saw that no matter what AFB or virtually anybody else was doing in the field, we were remaining somewhere around a 70% unemployment/underemployment figure. And so maybe what AFB needed to do, said some, was to get out of the employment business and not try to tackle that particular issue, leave it to somebody else. There were others who felt that AFB couldn't be everything to everybody in terms of age as well, and therefore perhaps AFB ought to get out of trying to have any influence on the subject of education. The end result is neither of those took place, though there was some prioritization that took place. And in that, it was decided that AFB needed to be a player that affected components that affected all of these groups and issues. So they decided to stay very heavily involved in the issues of technology, its accessibility for employment, its accessibility for education, and its accessibility for those who don't need it for either, but they need it as a matter of getting through their daily lives. Case in point would be accessible glucose monitors, for example. Also, they decided to stay in the area of literacy. Here they define literacy as much more than simply the ability to read and write, but rather to do so in Braille, in large print, and technology literacy as well. That is, not just a matter of getting the device that's accessible, but also knowing how to use it effectively. And lastly, to not forget that more than 50% of those who are blind or visually impaired in the United States are 65 years of age and older, most of whom don't identify themselves as blind or visually impaired directly, but rather simply a person who doesn't see as well as they used to or has a vision problem, those kinds of things, to make sure that they don't get lost, because so much of our country's energies are directed toward the first two groups, that is school-age kids, and those who are of employment age. So they really distilled it down to those basic activities and, of course, governmental relations activities that, again, support all of those. Take a look at what AFB has been involved with from a policy point of view. And it's been things such as accessible textbooks. Yep, does sound like education. Cell phones and those kinds of things. Again, it sounds like something that supports a blind person in daily living. And of course, those kind of things directly lead to things like employment and quality of life issues. So I would say that AFB sees itself as an entity that brings together the interests of many groups. They're certainly involved in AACB. They'll be at the convention this summer and will be presenting its highest honor to a non-professional in the field of blindness, to Carol McCarroll, at our opening ceremonies. They're very much involved with NFB, participating in studies and work groups associated with that consumer organization. Involved in the World Blind Union, their current vice president in charge of education, although she's kind of semi-retired, is the current treasurer of the World Blind Union. That's Susan Spungen. So again, they're attempting to draw together all that exists between professionals and consumers and to make sure that system change occurs when at all possible as a result of advocacy.
A hard question for you, Brian. Do you think that AFB would now regard itself as kind of an arbiter, an entity that places itself somewhere in the center of things and attempts to encourage other components of the blindness system to undertake change?
I think consensus is always desirable as far as AFB is concerned. However, it tends to take its professional staff, look at all of the information available on a given topic or issue, develop a policy that the organization thinks would best serve the needs of blind and visually impaired people, and then attempt to get other entities to rally around them in coalition, either just with themselves in one organization or as many organizations as possible in order to push that agenda forward. There are times, certainly, when those organizations are the ones that raise the hue and cry on a given issue, and AFB becomes an after-the-fact partner rather than a leading partner. But it really likes to think of itself as taking the lead on things and then drawing other partners into that activity, that promotion of an idea or concept.
Excellent. Brian, thanks very much for your forthright comments on the role that AFB is currently playing. Let's open it now and see if people have some specific questions for you that I haven't asked.
This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. I think I heard somewhere on, I don't know, general vision impairment and blindness or some other such thing, that the AFB had something to do with helping get started the blind rehabilitation program over at Western Michigan University.
AFB had a lot to do with the whole development of the blindness-related areas of employment like O&M, orientation, mobility, rehabilitation, teaching, et cetera, and turning those into true professions that both had a body of knowledge published so that they could be a profession, again, AFB Press, entities that were willing to develop curriculum and promote the education of individuals to go into the field of blindness by promoting things like the program and in there in Michigan and down in Florida and here in Massachusetts over at University of Massachusetts Boston campus and many, many others. They also have worked to try to keep separate agencies alive and well. You'll find them always there with us when we try to keep a school for the blind open or a agency for the blind as a separate agency. Again, believing in the value of specialized services as well as the value of mainstreaming when appropriate, both in terms of education and employment. They've been a partner there with virtually every organization, either helping it through its birth pangs or sometimes during that transition from if you will, a hope and a dream into something that's a little bit more solid and established, and sometimes just helping it hold on just one more year.
Sunisi from Atlanta. Back in 1976, I went to a workshop that AFB developed or organized called Aging and Vision Loss, or Aging and Blindness, I don't remember now which. And when you think back of 1975 or 31 years or 76, 30 years ago, the concept of vision loss among the elderly was really not well disseminated and certainly was not talked about. So AFP, again, was in the forefront of trying to bring together the field of blindness and the field of aging. I'm curious what has happened with one of the latest initiatives from AFP the last few years, which was the development of some competencies and possibly certification mechanisms for assistive technology instructors in the blindness field.
Good question. Each day when I go to the Carroll Center for the Blind to run the computer training center there, about 6 feet from my right hand is the culmination of all of those focus groups and efforts of many, many people around the country. It's a set of videotapes and text files of one kind or another that describes what kind of competencies the field believes that individuals who hang up their shingle as access technology trainers, installers, engineers, etc., should have. AFB's funding for that lasted only through the development of the original, if you will, beta product. They thought that what they would do would be to mass produce a multimedia kit and send it around the country. However, by the time they got it all in the can, so to speak, the money ran out, and they didn't have the money to do that development and distribution. So they were looking for a new way to get it out. So they have placed a copy of it in the hands of two or three different organizations, such as mine, and we've all been encouraged to find a way to take that content and make it our own in our own effort. So here at the Carroll Center for the Blind, we are going to be making that a series of online classes intended to train the trainer and also so to train that trainer to be able to pass competency testing if and when it is made available by one of the university programs or perhaps as an offshoot of something happening out at CSUN, for example.
Well, this is Debbie Grubb from Bradenton, Florida. I love early history of the blindness movement, history in general. And I was wondering if you could touch a little bit and maybe give us some anecdotal information, just anything that pops into your mind about the early days of AFB, how it really got started, how Helen Keller became involved in it, and who else in the field of blindness that we might know about, notable individuals, were involved, and how it really got off the ground.
Boy, I wish I was a historian and can fill in that gap. I will tell you that I've had association with lots of different blindness organizations, both of and for the blind over the years, and many of them kind of claim to be a shirt-tail relative, if you will, of Helen Keller and her activities. But none is even close to the association that Helen Keller had with the American Foundation for the Blind. They have an incredible archive of material there, handwritten material, slates and styluses, photographic histories, writings of other people about Helen Keller, the biggest collection of her personal letters, an incredible wealth of information. When the two airliners crashed into the World Trade Center, you can imagine that had some impact on AFB. Many of its employees live in Manhattan. And as the clouds of dust rolled down the streets and the buildings collapsed or had to be demolished. And one of those was the Helen Keller, I think it's called the Helen Keller Foundation, if I'm sure me correctly, and somebody else may know the name of it better than I do. And they had a collection of their own of Helen Keller archival material. And when their building eventually collapsed, and they had to reestablish themselves. By the way, at one point, the two organizations actually had a shared board of trustees. One set of trustees acted as the trustees for both organizations. AFB looked into its archives, and when there were duplicates, shared those duplicates to reestablish this, if you will, core collection for this organization that was devastated by the collapse of the World Trade Center. There are certainly a number of interesting individuals. One from the Carroll Center who went over there. People may or may not know that the Carroll Center for the Blind is named after Father Thomas Carroll. And one of his trainees in his early years here in Massachusetts was a former director of AFB, Mr. Gallagher. And I heard from some of my coworkers about Father Carroll attempting to teach Mr. Gallagher to be a little less of a, what's the right word to look for? A little more aggressive, a little less passive in things. And he took Mr. Gallagher and he put him in roller skates and took him down to a major intersection about a half a mile from the Carroll Center and had him roller skating up and down the sidewalks and cross streets to try to get him to think outside the box.
There is a very good book, and I'm trying to see if I can bring all of the data back. My recollection is that it's called The Unseen Minority, and I am thinking that the last name of the author is Kessler, K-O-E-S-T-L-E-R. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm right. But this lady has really done a good job of cataloging the early history of AFB. One of the other things that AFB was certainly responsible for doing was creating a kind of a nationwide push that they very much developed materials for that led to the creation of divisions of blind services in virtually every state. I would venture to say that without the American Foundation for the Blind, we wouldn't have specialized agencies for blind folks because through the use of Helen Keller and in a variety of other ways, they took very seriously the idea of ensuring that people who are blind did have access to a broad range of training. In their history, of course, they were also responsible for being one of the prime movers in the creation of an animal known as the Comstock Commission, which took a look at services to blind people in the 1960s and recommended the organization of an entity whose job it would be to set some standards that would then be used to accredit agencies for the blind. And this organization came to be known as the National Accreditation Council.
Paul, this is Marlena from Seattle. Just a quick comment. The book is The Unseen Minority. The author is Francis Kessler, and it is available at least through RFB&D.
It's also in the NLS Talking Book Program, I know. I'm not sure whether it's on Bookshare. I am not certain.
Good morning. It's James from the UK. Question for the chap from AFB. What is the organization's policy with regard to blind individuals who cannot afford computer hardware and access software?
So AFB was very fundamental in expanding the amount of dollars available to serve the needs of older blind persons. AFB has been very much involved in recent efforts to expand Medicaid, I think it's Medicaid, I always get it back, Medicaid or Medicare, support for low vision services, for example, which could extend to dealing with issues such as screen magnification and those kinds of things. But in terms of coming up with any kind of wholesale answer to the problem that dollars and cents make a difference between one's ability to use access technology or not, I don't think AFB has a real answer to that question.
Brian, this is Sue Amater. I have a question. If someone wants to become involved in AFB committees or maybe some of the employment projects or anything along the lines that you've mentioned earlier tonight, what would be our best recourse?
Two things. One is to correspond with Paul Schrader, who's a vice president of AFB. Contacting him and expressing your interest certainly would help. Another thing that would help is if you would indicate it to me by email. As a trustee, I'm frequently asked to make recommendations for committees, and you can send email to me at Brian, B-R-I-A-N, Charlson, C-H-A-R-L-S-O-N, at comcast.net, C-O-M-C-A-S-T.net.
And could you give us contact info if you have it right there for Paul?
AFB email addresses, I say tend to be, because there's no absolute in all of it. Usually it's firstname.lastname@afb.net. Again, firstname.lastname@afb.net. And I can never spell Paul Schrader's last name. Anybody here have an idea?
My belief is that his email address is pws@afb.net.
That's one of them. He has two.
I think his last name is Schroeder, something like that.
The PWS is for those people that can't spell last name, like us.
Yeah, pws@afb.net would certainly get to Paul. The spelling of his name is, in fact, correct, you guys. You're good. I'm impressed. Another question for Brian.
Brian, this is Ann Byington. I have two compliments and then a question. I think the addition of Dr. Karen Wolf to the AFB staff in terms of her ability to create really usable information for people looking for jobs and all the how-to materials is exceptionally intelligent on somebody's part. She is just wonderful. The other compliment I have is for your Atlanta office. We had a assistive technology project for Kansas conference last week, and Ike Presley came and did a really good overview of assistive technology for blind and visually impaired people. My question is, if I go to the website or talk to you later, is there a way that I can find out about the glucometer developments that are going on from AFB?
The answer is yes. Go to the website, choose technology as one of the main topics on the home page, and in there you should find the Access World magazine, and it's searchable, and they did an entire issue on accessible glucose monitors, not only what ones currently are accessible, but much to our horror, there appear to be more accessible glucose monitors going out of production than into production. So you will see there a bit on what the future of this technology seems to be at this time, and also what kind of standards an organization who wants to produce accessible durable medical equipment can go through to assure that things like screens are readable and what kind of issues they should concern themselves in making medical information accessible to blind people.
One of the issues that the blindness field has had in the past has been that a lot of what we said about technology was anecdotal. We had a notion that such and such a screen reader was better, or we would say that for a large print user, this cell phone is better than that cell phone. But we wouldn't really have a clear indicator of why that is. And I think probably, for me anyway, the most important work that the Technology Center has done is to think through the beginnings of some methods that can be used to arrive at data that's a little bit more objective and that begins to set some usability standards for products.
One other thing I think people might want to know about AFB and where we're going and the like is it doesn't make much sense to see what happens sometimes. When you see AFB open an office or close an office, that's almost always to do with the potential in that community to raise funds to support one of the major functions of AFB. We had a board of trustees member in Atlanta who gave us entree to literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. But for us to have access to that, it had to be a local activity. Wham! Suddenly Atlanta became a center based on literacy. The same thing has taken place in Dallas. We closed our Chicago office because, quite honestly, it wasn't the center of fundraising for any of our major functions. We didn't think that the staff were doing a poor job. For example, Paul Schrader used to be the director of that office, but it simply didn't generate funds by us maintaining an office outside of New York. San Francisco may go the same way. Currently, they're down to a staff of two because, again, the funds don't seem to be dependent on having a local presence to pull that off. So we'll see how that one goes. The Huntington, West Virginia office is direct, its location is as a direct result of access to funds. AFB received a bequest of controlling interest in mining rights in a big chunk of West Virginia. But half of the funds raised by the royalties for the mining of that coal have to be spent in the state of West Virginia. Now, it can benefit everybody, but it has to happen in West Virginia. So sometimes it's how the money flows that causes you to be able to tackle certain things and not be able to tackle others. One of the other things I find really interesting as a trustee is people may not be aware, but every maker of talking books for the NLS program, and I repeat, every maker of books, even though they bid for the right each year to make those books for NLS, not a one of them is making any money, and in fact, every one of them is losing money by doing it. AFB is no exception to that rule, and each year we have to reexamine whether or not we can afford to lose that many hundreds of thousands of dollars to support the creation of more talking books through a process that, in my opinion at least, is very much broken.
What are the plans, AFB's plans, in this whole context of transformation into digital talking books?
So let me see if I can describe this properly. Those who haven't been really paying real close attention to who's producing the books they're listening to may not have realized that for a couple of years, AFB owned Talking Book Publishing of Denver, Colorado. The NLS contracting process required that they not give more than 500 titles to a single entity. Out of the roughly 1,750 titles or so that they're produced each year as talking books. So each year we'd all go into a bidding process and we'd bid against one another and we'd underprice ourselves in hopes that we'd get something to support the organization as opposed to getting nothing. There are a whole bunch of issues associated with the future of the digital talking book process. When AFB talks about staying in or getting out of the talking book production side of things, but they said that even though we get out of the production of talking book business, we have no intention of ever getting out of the issues surrounding access to books. So in the same way that AFB created the original talking book, AFB intends to be a major player in the future of digital talking books. You're probably going to see that more in the area of policy than in the area of developing specific equipments and or formats. It appears that while NLS has been talking a great deal about not using a CD as a form of providing access to digital talking books, but to use a flash cartridge kind of approach, and they certainly, in terms of self-production, are absolutely committed to that. It appears that they are only going to allow you and me to download talking books from their website if we then take those downloaded books and burn them onto a CD and play them in a very specific type of third-party produced player. I imagine AFB is going to get involved in the debate as to the ethics of that approach.
Has AFB been involved in the issue with RFB&D, where you've got to get the key and the whole thing?
They, in fact, have had discussions with RFB&D during that whole process. Basically, this is an issue of what they call digital rights management. RFB&D, in an attempt to try to reassure the publishers who allowed them to record their books and distribute them for the use of blind people, agreed to, as they moved over to CD-based, to include an encryption process so that only individuals who were RFBND patrons could actually play those back. So AFD has been involved in those discussions. They have been a major player.
Do you see the AFB's role in this whole issue as trying to take a different position, say, than RFBND has taken? And if so, do you have a sense as to whether AFB would go so far as to, for instance, say what Canada says, which is, as long as you've got a closed distribution system, there really is no reason why you can't distribute books that are unencrypted. And perhaps you could also explain how you encrypt tapes.
Well, it's clear that four-track tapes aren't encrypted. They've never been encrypted. We were allowed to record in that format. But it was also in the day when Audible publishing wasn't as widespread or as fast-growing as it currently is. But I do think that AFB has shown itself to the world as being interested in both protecting the rights of blind and visually impaired people without imperiling the intellectual property rights of those who produce material. If you, like you described the Canada situation, I don't believe, in fact, that AFB is going to support that kind of open standard. I think eventually they are going to agree to some form of DMR, if that's in fact how the industry wants to handle it, but it's going to have to be some form of universal key. Well, there's a couple of things I think that we as advocates can do. One is ask the hard questions. Many of these decisions are in fact happening at NLS, and we need to be asking questions of those who are making decisions at NLS about these kinds of things. At no time during the ACB convention, and I was there and spoke with Kurt Silke multiple times, did he ever tell us about this issue of limiting downloads to only download and burn, not download and port to portable players directly.
Clearly access to literature and as broad a range of literature as is possible is an important objective for any organization working for people who are blind to work toward. In that context, what do you see the role that AFB is going to play in creating broader access to some of the materials, for instance, that are in the Miguel Library, some of the materials that are a part of the archives of the Journal of Visual Impairment, but which are only available at a cost that most blind people can't afford?
AFB had an arrangement with the Bookshare that any time an individual requested an AFB title that was not available in electronic form, these are older texts, these are not new productions, all new productions are made accessible in electronic form as well as frequently on cassette and as braille formatted files, all new text. But where many of AFB's texts stay in print for an extended period of time beyond anybody's ability to retrieve the electronic form. So they have made arrangements with Bookshare that anytime they get a request for an AFB publication that's not available electronically, that they would provide Bookshare with a copy of it for purposes of scanning and placing into the Bookshare collection and thereby make it accessible to those individuals who want it. Paul, remind me, what's the current cost of an annual Bookshare subscription?
It's $75 a year and a $25 sign-up fee. So we're still creating two tiers of access to information.
I couldn't agree with you more. I totally disagree with the policy. I would and have been advocating that AFB say that such a book can be made available through Bookshare without an individual needing to be a member of Bookshare, but that Bookshare would do the scanning and placing on its collection.
Brian, thanks very much. We actually have only really begun to scratch the surface with regard to AFB. There are some new directions that AFB is proposing to unveil over the next little while, and we may be able next week to hear from some AFB people about some of those new directions. Some of them are actually at least potentially very exciting and a little controversial as well. In particular, they have to do with what AFB might be able to do to get more actively involved in playing a role in determining the kinds of adjustment that people who lose their sight later in life have to go through. In addition to that, we really haven't spent the time it deserves on some of the policy issues that AFB is wrestling with in Washington. There's a good deal more, I think, that we can say on some of the work that AFB is currently doing through its National Literacy Center in terms of promoting the development of some new training programs specifically related to Braille. And there are a number of other initiatives that AFB is undertaking at the moment that will be the subject of Tuesday topics next week. I'd like to thank everyone for being a part of tonight's broadcast, and particularly like to thank Brian for answering questions as forthrightly and controversially as he did. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community. Good night. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we'll continue our discussion of the American Foundation for the Blind. Next week, we'll take a look at some new initiatives that AFB is getting involved with, or at least is considering, that have to do with what people who are getting older and lose vision can do. Where do they find the resources that they need to help them adjust to this sudden and drastic change in their lives? And what work is AFB doing in Washington, D.C.? What work is AFB also doing with regard to technology, Braille literacy, and the teaching of Braille throughout the country? These are just some of the questions that we will consider on our second program on the American Foundation for the Blind. Join us on Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.